Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Plus,
here's John Williams.
Weather coverage. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio, Tel 3. We always appreciate you joining us for this little show of ours. On social media, remember, WGN King John is how you find me and my tweets and my texts and my posts and all of that stuff on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter, WGN King John, WGN King John on social media. I'm not king yet. I want to be someday. I think it'll help out. Paperwork's tied up with Cook County, but things will just go a lot more quickly. There'll be none of this debating. They'll just say, hey, what do you think, King? And I'll lay down the law. Not because it's about me, but because it's about you. Unless the decisions are really complicated, and then I'll have somebody else do them. That's what you get to do when you're king. Tom Skilling is the meteorologist at Channel 9. You frequently hear him here on WGN Radio. And, Tom, what's going on in the Chicago area today?
Well, John, nature has put on quite a show. A line of thunderstorms that started last night up in North Dakota has been making its way across the area now. It's come all the way south across Wisconsin. It's produced one of these dramatic shelf clouds, and they're always a foreboding sight to see. It's that wall of cloudiness on the front end of the storms behind which you get driving rains. We've had a tornado touchdown that has been reported down around Sheridan, Illinois, north of 42nd Road there. Not aware of any damage or any from that. And we've had some reports of heavy rain, 56 hundredths of an inch DeKalb, 3/4 inch hail at Freeport. We had 1 inch diameter hail out toward Marseilles, and reports just come in around just southeast of Plainfield down in Will County. And they put a severe thunderstorm watch in effect from the area just south of us down through Indiana and eastward through northwest Indiana. Now, I think this first line is going to pull out of here. We'll get a quiet period, probably get some sun to poke out, and any showers we get, you know, for a good chunk of the afternoon from this point forward, once you get away from those storms south of us that are moving away, we'll probably have a quiet period and see redevelopment this evening again. So we're getting some model indications will be warm and humid, and that we may get some scattered new storms to start firing 6 to 8 p.m., and that would run through, say, 10 or 11 or midnight tonight. It could rain beyond that, but that would be the period, that 6 to 8 p.m. up till 10 or 11 o'clock when some of these storms could be severe. And by severe, we define that as a storm producing winds of 58 miles per hour or greater, or 1 inch or greater hail. That constitutes a severe storm. So it's quite interesting. We're on the south flank of a jet stream cutting through this warm, humid air. So these storms that bubble up in this environment tend to reach up into these high-altitude winds and bring some of them down in the form of wind gusts. And they can also start rotating, and that's where you get a tornado to spin up every now and then. It's a slight risk of severe weather being assessed. They have a 5-level risk scale the Storm Prediction Center puts out. This is at the lower end of the scale, but I've seen many tornadoes and severe thunderstorms dance across the area in slight risk environments. So this is not to be, put aside or totally dismissed.
From the west and the south, it looks like the metro is going to miss most of this afternoon. You say they pop up again this evening, maybe around 6 o'clock or so. Do you think that is going to more directly hit the metro area, and will those be severe?
You know, Sean, these storms always, they're very selective. They'll hit one area, not another. It's pretty hard to lay out with precision precisely what area is going to get hit, but I must tell you that the metro area is at risk this evening, and so I don't think you dismiss the threat of additional severe weather with the passage of this first line, as dramatic as it's been. And your assessment is right, John. The heaviest stuff has appears to have affected area just west of us. I've gotten some pretty interesting shots from folks out at O'Hare of the line coming in there, and down in Will County as well. There have been some pretty good storms there, but it certainly hasn't come through the city. We've had downpours here and gusty winds, but most of the reports that I've gotten, even in the areas affected out to the west of us, like out toward Dixonall and DeKalb, indicates where they had sirens running for a time as the tornado warning was issued out there, indicated it comes through pretty expeditiously. You're hit hard with gusty winds and heavy rains and hail, and then it moves on.
I know you got to move on too, Tom. It sounds like you're mobile today, so I'll let you get to where you got to be, but we sure appreciate your time and expertise, sir.
Oh, John, always happy to talk to you. I'm here in the home weather office working, so I don't have the direct line to so forgive the cell communication, but it's always great talking to you, John.
By the way, Steve Bertrand, did you need to jump in?
Well, Tom, I'm just going to let you know that the National Weather Service has just issued another warning, this one a little closer to home, for Cook, Lake, and Will County. So we're watching this one. The severe thunderstorm located over Matteson, 60-mile-an-hour wind gust, quarter-size hail. Some of the towns in the line of the storm include Hammond, Gary, St. John. These are in Indiana, Tinley Park, Cal City, Portage, Maryville, Chicago Heights, in that area there.
So, again, a little to the south, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And that those storms will be moving away from us. And then there's some other ones that have cropped up in southern Wisconsin in some areas. All these have an east-southeastward movement. And so the storm you indicate right there, Steve, is headed into that watch box area down to the south of us. And view this as kind of the first wave of a multi-pronged severe weather situation, the second one to come in this evening and for a time early tonight. And we can get some locally heavy rains with this as well.
Welcome to spring, everybody. All right, Tom.
Yeah.
We'll be listening. We'll be watching. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Steve.
That's WGN's Tom Skilling, the most recognized and trusted voice in weather in America, and maybe the world, and I'm almost not kidding. I posted on my Twitter page today a picture of me, I'm going to say hugging Steve, but you know I don't hug strangers anymore, but with my arm around the woman who greets you when you go to Lou Mitchell's, the diner downtown Chicago near the Willis Tower.
You are such a Chicagoan now.
The storied diner Lou Mitchell's. I met some buddies for breakfast this morning. And there's this lady named Donna who is the greeter there. She gives you your little donut or milk dud, and you get your seat, and you have your breakfast. And then about 30 minutes into the three of us sitting there having coffee and eating some eggs, they go clang, 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 and big bell rings. And they get on the PA, and they say, attention, everyone. Donna, I don't know exactly what they called her, but she would be the person that greets you and gets you to your table. Your hostess or whatever celebrates her 91st birthday. It was either today or yesterday. And she has been at Lou Mitchell's, they said, for 40 years. So that means she took the job at 51, and now she's 91, and she's still running around, I mean like a top, greeting people, chatty, handing out donuts. She sent me on my booth, and she goes, wait a minute. And then she gets somebody over there. She says, that bench seat isn't just the way it should be. Fix it. And then they fixed it. And she is running that place. She is 91 years old, either today or yesterday. I got a picture of me and her with our arms around each other, smiling real big. And so if you are at Lou Mitchell's this week, make sure that you pat Donna on the back or whatever it is that we do now. Greet her. Wish her a belated happy birthday. Her picture with me is on my Twitter page. I'm WGN King John on the Twitter. John, east of Olano in Yorkville. It's over now, but it was horrible. And here is a picture texted into us of one of those wall clouds. Boy, I wonder what people used to think, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago when wall cloud systems would come in. They must have felt it was the gods or God.
I always thought that about sunrises and sunsets. You think people were like, oh, no, we're all going to die. The sun is leaving.
Come back. And the next day, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
By the way, this says Olano, but you're right, Elif. This must mean Plano, east of Plano in Yorkville, because Yorkville is east of Plano. And that's my old stomping ground. So there they are in Kendall County. And this wall of darkness is just moving through. And you think if God was mad and he's like, okay, guess what? Game over. it would look like this. It would look like one of these just big green black mobs coming over the head, over your head. And I guess some of you are dealing with that today. John, this storm event looks like it's going to be here all weekend. Yeah. I'm hopefully taking part of a half marathon Sunday morning in Grant Park at 7 a.m. Weather patterns can change. Is it looking okay? Sorry I didn't get that question to Tom Skilling. If we get a chance to answer that more fully, we will. But as you heard Tom say, some of these things are going to pop up, and it's really hard to say exactly when and where they're going to be. Now, there's a low-pressure system to our east. He was saying stuff like that. More wall clouds. Lots of pictures of wall clouds texted, and thank you for doing that. John, heard a storm report on WGN about 45 minutes ago saying half-dollar size hail. Don't think most kids or people know how big a half dollar is anymore. We need to find a new way to quantify that. Really? How big is a half dollar? It's about that big. Actually, a half dollar is pretty big. It's about the size of an Oreo cookie. No, it's not as big as an Oreo cookie. It's about the size of a ginger snap. So hail the size of ginger snaps falling west of the metro area today. By the way, when I was at Lou Mitchell's, yes, Steve, I do like to pretend like I'm a sophisticated Chicagoan. My friend Mr. Carafa said, you know this thing about Game of Thrones? And I said, yeah, I've heard about that. And he said, I think that the last episode jumped the shark. Don't worry, we're not going to have a conversation about Game of Thrones because I'm not very good at it anyway. But I do know what he was talking about, and he tended to agree with people who, and I'm surprised I hadn't heard it until today, but the last episode where the dragon is just scorching the earth and there's a lot of fire, it's like, wow, that was cool. But of the 80 minutes in the episode, about 59 minutes of them, by my count, were that. And he said, yeah, you know, they just overdid it. It was too much violence, too much destruction, too much cool dragon stuff, even though we all love the cool dragon stuff. Lauren Lapka, your views on it somewhat jumping the shark.
I mean, jumping the shark, when you said that initially, I was wondering if he meant, you know, everything happened so fast, like the conclusions that
he was also referring to. And he said, yeah, they had so much to tie up that it was like, now we did this and now we did that and now we did that. And he thought it was a bit much that way.
Yeah, too. I would agree. I think that's pretty common thought of fans of the show, that just in general, you know, everything has been building to this final season and now everything is being rushed.
Yeah,
which is a shame. But at the same time, I think they're doing a pretty good job with the time that they have left.
Yeah. Well, Richard Roper tweeted today that the idea, there's a petition out there. He tweeted about a petition I know nothing about demanding that HBO refilm season 8.
Okay. And, you know, the like $15 million it takes to make an episode, where are they going to get that?
And but we aren't satisfied with the way you're doing this. And so we, the fans, demand. I just love that. I don't know who you people are with your hands on your hips, but God bless you.
A lot of times they just, fans like to do that because they need to channel their anger and frustration that the show is ending in some way.
Yeah, that may be part of it.
It's like a breakup. You're like, I never really liked you. I don't care that you're leaving. But you do.
The Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record here at WGN Radio, addressed right out of the gate today. The Trump Organization says fewer people are coming to Trump Tower due to the city of Chicago's gun violence. That was the quote-unquote question. The Trump Organization says fewer people are coming to Trump Tower. Business is off at the signature Trump Tower, they say, because of the gun violence in our city. We asked you what you thought about that. You had two options. I buy that. It's worrisome to me. Or I don't buy that. Might be the name on the building. So the clouds have moved through, and I actually see through them. I wouldn't call it a blue sky, but a high, bright white sky downtown Chicago.
Yeah, well, they're still dealing with it in the south suburbs in, Kankakee, Bradley, Manteno, and that area. But yeah, Hopefully then that will be the end of it for a time anyway.
Pardon me, all weather's local, so here it's not so bad, and for you it may be just terrible. And again, that severe thunderstorm warning is in effect until 2:15 this afternoon for southeastern Kankakee County in northeastern Illinois, Iroquois County in east central Illinois. We have until 1:45, so say for 6 more minutes, pardon me, until 2 o'clock, so for 21 more minutes, a severe thunderstorm warning for east central Will County, southeastern Cook County, and Lake County of northwestern Indiana. And then here's the one until 1:45. Some of these overlap, but I'm just passing them along. Severe thunderstorm warning until 1:45 for northern Livingston, east central LaSalle, and Grundy County in northeastern Illinois. That's my old stomping ground, Grundy County. Elifa, is that our guest on the line? Not yet. Oh, that's too bad if this isn't going to happen, because it's a really interesting story. I'll pause here, and then if we don't tell it today, we'll tell it tomorrow. But here's the beginning of Diana Simpson's story in the Chicago Tribune. Imagine you take your car to the body shop for some repairs, expecting to have it back in a week or so. But as the weeks pile up, you start to worry and become less comforted by the assurances they are just waiting on parts. Finally, they come clean. A shop employee was driving it a few weeks ago and got pulled over. When the police discovered he was driving without a valid driver's license, they impounded your car. A routine trip to the shop is now a nightmare. It becomes worse as you discover that the city won't give your car back unless you pay thousands of dollars in fines and fees for the towing and the storage of your car. That is precisely what the city of Chicago is doing to Veronica Walker Davis and Jerome Davis. It demanded that they pay for someone else's illegal activity, said Walker Davis. The city made me feel like a criminal, even though I did nothing wrong. They dropped their car off. The guy that's supposed to be fixing the car takes it out for a ride. He doesn't have a license. He gets pulled over. The car gets impounded. The shop keeps saying we're waiting for parts. Meanwhile, every day they're racking up fines. The city seizes and impounds cars for 24 offenses and then assesses penalties. The offenses include things such as littering, driving with a suspended license. The fines stretch up to $3,000, and the city charges a towing fee plus daily storage fees that add up to $1,000 a month. It's a massive system. In 2017 alone, the city impounded more than 22,000 cars and imposed more than $28 million in fines and impound fees under this program. And, you know, a lot of people either don't have the money or for some reason they don't claim their car. The city crushes the cars. And I don't know what happened to Veronica's car, if it got crushed. Is that her attorney at least on the line? All right, we'll start there. Or if it's somewhere and they're waiting to get it back. Veronica's set to join us, and hopefully she'll be on the phone shortly. But in the meantime, Diana Simpson is an attorney at the Institute of Justice who's helping her and others like her out. Hey, Diana, this is John Williams. Or, no, it's Diana. This is John, and you're on. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. So that's the story. It was in the Tribune. What's the status of her car? Is it still a car? Where is it?
You know, we don't know. She went to pick it up, and they told her that it had been disposed of, and that's all that they could tell her. The city really has three options when they dispose of cars underneath the ordinances. They can crush it and sell it for scrap metal. They can sell it at auction, and then if the police want to keep it, they keep it for their own police uses. And so it could be any of those three things, and we just don't know.
How does the city not know? I mean, if they had it towed somewhere, where is it? Who has it? Its status must be known.
Someone probably knows where it is and what happened to it. They haven't been able to get it together to tell Veronica what the status is or to tell us yet.
Now, who are you? What do you guys do?
So I am an attorney at the Institute for Justice, and we are a national nonprofit that litigates cases across the country to defend property rights, among other things. And we have filed a major class action against the city of Chicago. We filed it a couple of weeks ago to challenge the city's impound program. There are a number of different things that are unconstitutional about how the city impounds cars, and we are challenging that, teaming up with Veronica and a couple of other property owners.
So it says 22,000 cars have been imposed, 28 million impounded, and $28 million in fine assessed in 2017. I don't suppose all of those cars have been destroyed. I mean, I wonder what the numbers break down on that.
You know, that's something that we'll seek to find out in discovery. You know, we have some information now about what's happened to everything. And then as we get through the litigation, we'll be able to ask the city to basically document what they've done with different cars and all of those things. And we will try to find all of that information out.
How long has Veronica been without her car then?
Oh, goodness. I guess, a little or almost a year now at this point.
Wait,
yeah, she had taken it. Yeah, she had taken it to a body shop last May of 2018, I guess. And in June, it was impounded. 3 weeks after it was impounded, she found out that that's where it was, and she's been trying to get it back ever since.
A car. A whole car.
Yes.
Not just part of a car, John. A whole car. I mean, I could... This just boggles the mind. A, that the city did that and thought they had a leg to stand on, and B, they can't find the car. It makes me sound like it got pancaked at some recycling center.
The impound lots are massive. There are about 5 different lots spread throughout the city, and there's one a little bit south of the city that is just absolutely huge. It's really hard to comprehend its size unless you go there, and there are just rows upon rows of cars that have been impounded.
That. But, Diana, my guess would be then whatever that is, somebody should say it's in – have you been to a mall? There's a lot of cars there, too, and you know where your car is. They say it's in aisle 8, spot 14. That's where we put it. You make it sound like there's no – plan for what they do with these impounded cars.
You know, I'm not sure that there is. The city has a bunch of ordinances they have to follow when they're going through the impound system, from the moment they seize your car and tow it to the moment that there's a hearing and then to its ultimate release or its disposal. But the city's not always following those ordinances. We've been hearing that there are a number of problems with how this whole system is supposed to run, and the city is supposed to send immediate notice once a car has been impounded, and they're not always doing that. And so if they're missing this one particular aspect of it, it reasons that they're missing other aspects as well, and they're just ignoring their own laws that they're supposed to be following.
Seems to me like if that guy's driving the car illegally, he doesn't have a driver's license, he's in trouble, but they ought to be able to tell who owns the vehicle. Clearly, this guy didn't. So it seems to me like the obligation would be on the city to say, hey, we took your car, and we're giving it back. But beyond that, if there's a suit here, wouldn't it be with the garage? It was their employee that was illegally driving it.
Well, so that's a separate issue, and there is, you know, perhaps some claim against the garage for their illegal activity. The city of Chicago, though, really authorizes this, and so it doesn't matter who was driving the car. It doesn't matter whether they had permission. The city of Chicago allows for the impound of cars for about 24 different criminal offenses, one of which is driving without a valid license. And then the owner of the car is then responsible for paying a penalty for those different criminal offenses, and it goes up to about $3,000 in costs. And then on top of that penalty, you have to pay a towing fee of about $150, and then storage fees that are about $1,000 a month. And this is applied to the owner, and it doesn't matter if the owner wasn't the person driving the car. There are only 3 very narrow defenses available. Otherwise, the owner is stuck with the bill of paying this penalty, plus all of the fees, plus all of the hassle of going downtown 2, 3, 4 times for hearings, and then going to go and pick up your car.
That makes sense if the person is the owner and they're guilty of a crime. But that's, well, we have a crime. It wasn't the owner that was guilty of the crime. It just, I can't believe they did not carve out this scenario as a possible exception. So
right.
They need to fix that. But I want to go back for a second to the company that allowed an employee to drive it illegally. It just seems to me, now maybe that company's insurance is going to not be interested in writing a check for a new car, but I still don't see how if you don't go after the garage that was fixing it, that their insurance company wouldn't be on the hook to make Veronica whole.
I mean, perhaps that's something that can be pursued. You know, our focus really in this lawsuit is trying to dismantle the city's impound system. As you said earlier, there were 22,000 cars, more than 22,000 cars in 2017 alone that were impounded. And the city's ordinances allow them to do this. The city's ordinances allow them to demand significant payment of penalties and fees from innocent owners who've done nothing wrong. And so that's the system we're really trying to dismantle so that we can help literally thousands of Chicagoans.
Yeah, I'm dismayed too, because you know what happens here, and I don't know Veronica or Jerome or husband, but I did talk to Veronica on the phone, and she sounded like a nice, bewildered lady who I'm just going to guess here, because this describes most people. doesn't have the resources or the experience to take on literally City Hall. And so they're just between a rock and a hard place. And so the idea that someone would steal my car, because that's what happened, and the city might crush it and then say, we don't know where it is. And by the way, we don't have anything for you. Go away. Is incomprehensible. That's just insane.
Well, and on top of that, so all of those things you just listed, but also, and by the way, you owe us thousands of dollars for the whole thing to begin with, well, because somebody else was driving your car without a license.
Are they doing that? Are they telling her she owes money?
I mean, that's how the system is set up. And so the penalties and fees are the car owner is responsible for those. And that's what, that's what she's going to be facing.
John, could you please tell us what body shop she took her car to? so we don't ever take our car there. I don't know. Do you?
Pardon?
Do you know which body shop she took her car to?
No, not off the top of my head. But, it's. The real problem here is that this could happen to anybody, and we've been talking with people who've had similar experiences, and unfortunately, Veronica's story is not unique, and that's a real problem in the city of Chicago.
708 just texted, oh, her car was crushed a long time ago. Okay, let me pause. The number is 312-981-7200. If you've got an angle on this story, I'd love to hear it. Call or text 312-981-7200. This is the story of a woman named Veronica. She and her husband Jerome took their car into the body shop to get fixed. The shop kept saying, oh, parts are coming, parts are coming. And after a few weeks, they realized there were no parts coming. Somebody took their car for a joyride that worked at the garage, got pulled over. They didn't have a valid driver's license. The cops confiscate the vehicle. The city has it. And a year later, not only do they not have that car, there's no hope they're going to get it. Our guest, Diana Simpson, is an attorney at the Institute of Justice. They're working on a suit against the city for this practice. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Diana Simpson is an attorney at the Institute of Justice. It's a national organization. She's working with at least one family in Chicago against the city of Chicago. Is this a class action or is this just something else, Diana?
Yeah, so we filed this as a class action and we'll be asking the court shortly to certify it as a class action so that we can represent really anyone who's had their car impounded under this particular program.
Cole, Elif, you said one of our listeners is going through the same thing and that's on line three. Okay, Cole, stay there. I'll try and get to you, but Art is dealing with something like this too. Hey, Art, you're on WGN. What's up?
Yeah, I have the same problem, but with the city of Montgomery. I sold the car over a year ago, and the person who bought it didn't change the title, then got stopped for drunk driving, and they impounded the vehicle. They wanted me to pay the fine for $500 and to get the car back, but I couldn't get it back because I had to prove ownership.
And the city's already sold it, so technically it's not yours. What a nightmare.
Yeah, it's already been disposed of. I have no idea.
So you literally don't have the car now? You won't have the car?
No, I never did have the car because I sold it a year before this happened.
Okay, so at least you're not out that, but did they say that you owe them $500?
Yeah, they still want me to pay $500 for the whatever they're... fines or whatever.
Yeah, Art, thanks for the call. Diana, it sure sounds like there's a lot of agencies and they're not communicating very well, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does. And so from my understanding of what Art just said, he's dealing with this in a different city other than the city of Chicago. But from what I understand about how Chicago's impound program works, there are a bunch of different people who are supposed to be talking to each other and they don't always.
Cole said, when I lost my car, the city of Chicago drove me to find it. I'm glad to hear that. I've got a bunch of calls here and texts from our listeners, but we're out of time for today. I want to continue to follow this story, though. We weren't able to connect with Veronica. Some of the questions I have, I know she'll be able to answer. So we'll pick this up in a week or two, and maybe you can join us again then, Diana. If people are similarly affected, how do they reach you guys? What's your organization?
So they should go onto our website, which is ij.org, and there's a form on there that they can submit some information, and we'll be able to take a look at it and give them a call if there's anything we might be able to do.
ij.org, that's instituteofjustice.org, ij.org. Diana,
exactly.
Nice to talk to you. Good luck. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, John.
Bye now. And by the way, a lot of you are texting us saying, this is not the city's problem. It's a problem with the insurance company and the garage. Fair enough. She's not that person. So maybe another attorney will help this family in that regard. But in the meantime, this does sound to me like if the city takes your car and crushes it and then wants you to pay for the towing, that's still on the city.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
It's exhausting.
Here's John Williams.
But I do it. Hi, we're in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 3. Saturdays, you can mostly hear me from 10 to noon on GM. I'll be at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove this Saturday, though. Boy, it's right there. Here comes Saturday. I'll be on stage with Thomas Jefferson, asking him stuff about then and today. And you can, too. Just a handful of tickets still available at WGNradio.com/Jefferson. We need to have that attorney and the woman she's representing, Veronica, back sometime in the next week or so, just to follow the story, because it was kind of frustrating, wasn't it? There were a lot of unanswered questions. My buddy Art here says, I don't think this is the city's problem. Thank you, Art. This is from 773. I have a somewhat similar story that my girlfriend experienced when she let her nephew use her car. He unfortunately had an accident. Her car was disabled. They said it was going to be towed to a city pound on Lower Wacker Drive, but it wasn't. Apparently, they left her car at the crash site and never towed it. I happened to look it up on the city's ticket website, and her car had accrued several tickets from being left at the crash location. John, I was on hold, so I could have answered your question. Insurance does not pay for damages caused by criminal acts, so the insurance company isn't going to be a source for this family, who's... I won't even go into all of the details. John, it sounds like Veronica's leaving out some information. So is her attorney. A lot of you are a little dubious about the version of the story I was giving you, but we'll continue to follow that. But a couple of you, oh, here it is. Is this the one, Elif?
Do you think? I'm not sure. I just found it because it involves an alderman in Chicago and an Audi. So, and I couldn't find the other story that that listener texted
me. I'm not sure if this is it or not. I won't take the time right now, but... Steve, maybe you remember. But you know this business of the city tows your car. Maybe you did nothing wrong. There's a mistake with whose car it is or whatever. Then the city says, we've got it. It's accruing a daily fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want it back, you've got to pay a lot of money. And you didn't do anything wrong to begin with. That's the case of this Veronica woman. But didn't that happen to an alderman or a state lawmaker? Their nephew or somebody was driving their car. It was involved in an accident or maybe a DUI or something.
Yeah.
And then he was on the hook for it, and he did nothing wrong. And he made great efforts to try and get that resolved, that is legislatively. And I that's all I remember. So if anybody else can fill in the blanks, we should go to that guy and ask him what his experience
was. Well, I think you're talking about an incident that involved Senator John Cullerton.
Yes.
And his son.
That does sound familiar.
But I don't remember all the car impounding and all of that stuff.
All right, we'll continue to work on this. Continue to listen to WGN for details this week and for the rest of your adult life. Speaking of controversial laws, Alabama's governor has just signed into law a bill that outlaws abortion, the only exception being if bearing the child could lead to the mother's death or if the child might be stillborn or die after birth. The law doesn't go into effect until November. And maybe it will never go into effect, given the inevitable court challenges. But you've probably got some questions about what's happening here, and I do too. Dana Hall McCain is a columnist for a host of Alabama newspapers, and she joins us now on WGN. Hi, Dana. It's John. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
So AL.com, Alabama.com, AL.com is where I find you. Your opinion pieces appear in newspapers in Huntsville. What other cities do they read you in down there?
Also in Birmingham and Mobile, Alabama.
Got it. So what's your beat then, the political scene?
I cover sort of the intersections of faith, culture, and politics, which is, as you can imagine, never, ever controversial.
Faith, culture, and politics. Yeah, I suppose politics and faith are more interwoven in Alabama than they are in Illinois.
They are intrinsically interwoven. We are a largely evangelical state, And really, since the 1980s, with the rise of the moral majority and what we know of now as the religious right, there has been sort of a conflation of faith and political activism in the Deep South, and Alabama is certainly no exception to that.
States are sovereign. I got into an argument with some friends on a podcast that we did today, and I said the people in Alabama can do whatever they want, and they don't have to care what some slick talk show hosts in Chicago think. They're sovereign. They get to enact laws any way they want, and if they stand up to a court standard, then they win. They get to do whatever they want. But there is also this notion of a separation between church and state. I just wonder what your thoughts are about that general divide down there.
Well, when we talk about, you know, the reasons for enacting pro-life legislation, obviously for people on a personal level, their views on life and the sanctity of life are often rooted in a religious worldview or a biblical worldview, but also for people who are, you know, scientific thinkers and constitutional thinkers. They believe that the preponderance of science right now makes no, you know, wonder about when life begins. We look at children now on 4D ultrasounds in the womb and watch them suck their thumbs and kick and make funny expressions, and they are undeniably human beings. And so if you understand that they are human beings in the womb, and you understand that our Constitution protects life and liberty for all people, then it becomes just a constitutional issue, and it doesn't really have to be anchored to a particular religious worldview.
And I guess that's why there's no exception then for rape or incest here. If it's life at conception or
that's right.
6 weeks,
it's a question. Yeah, it's a question of personhood. It's a question of when science tells us that a person is a person. And, you know, legislators in Alabama who introduced this bill have made no bones about the fact that it has been written with this very bold stroke, with no exceptions, for the very reason of establishing the personhood argument for future legal challenges. Their legal strategy here is to have this law challenged by the federal courts with the hope that it will travel all the way up the judicial food chain to the Supreme Court and will be the catalyst for a new examination of Roe versus Wade.
I wonder if, though, writing it that stringently almost dooms it. I mean, if they really do want to outlaw abortion or make it more restrictive in Alabama, maybe they should have dialed it back. This makes sense if you're looking for a fight, but it might not be a very practical solution.
That's a fair point to make. And, you know, legal analysts have been all over the board, you know, as I've listened to people discuss the effectiveness of this strategy over the past two or three days since the bill was passed by the Alabama Senate. Opinions vary widely about whether or not this is the most effective way to, you know, fully reduce the number of abortions to zero in the state of Alabama. And I guess only time will tell how the courts will treat it and what will happen there.
A lot of us have seen pictures online in the reporting of this of the 25 white men in the Senate who voted and made this a reality. But it started in the House. Can you talk about the demographics? Who voted for this? Did any women vote for this? Did any Democrats vote for this?
Yes, the Alabama legislature on both sides is overwhelmingly Republican and overwhelmingly conservative. And there are not enough women in the Alabama legislature, but many of the women who are there are staunch pro-life conservatives. And that's just, you know, they are a derivative of the culture that we live in. They are overwhelmingly evangelical and overwhelmingly conservative and pro-life. So, right. Yeah, there are a lot of pro-life women in the state of Alabama, and I'm no exception to that.
So I understand, but so it didn't cut a gender line, a racial line. I'm just trying to think of, you would think that the Democrats, for instance, such as they are down there, would be fighting this. Were they, the Democrats?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Most of the Democrats in the Senate walked out of the vote and didn't even participate. It was hotly contested by them, but they just really have no power. I mean, we have a super majority right now, and so, you know, they can make a, you know, an oral objection and let the record show that they were against this legislation, but they really lack any means to stop it.
If the belief is that life begins at conception, what about in vitro? If a couple is conceiving that way, then are those lives protected, or what's the status of that?
That's an excellent question, and there was some discussion in the Alabama Senate debate about that nuance in the law, and I believe there's actually language in this bill that talks about this applying to unborn children in the womb.
Yes, yes, I saw
therefore,
that too.
It would not apply to embryos that are frozen and fertilized and sitting and waiting to be implanted. Now, on an ethical level, I think it's a question that deserves pondering if life begins at conception, and we may, as this debate progresses, get to a place where that's something as a culture that we begin to discuss more and decide what we think about that.
Yeah, and I understand your description of the constituency there in Alabama, but I also have seen in a number of places today that 1 in 4 women have had an abortion. I find that hard to believe, but let's assume for a moment that's true. I wonder what women generally in Alabama think if 20 or 25% of them themselves have had this procedure.
I find that extraordinarily difficult to believe, particularly in the state of Alabama, where there are only 1 or 2 clinics that provide abortions. I mean, it would be almost logistically impossible for 1 in 4 women to, A, have had the need, and B, have had access to those services. So I'm going to push back on that statistic a little bit and say I find that to be a bit inflated, especially in a state like Alabama. In
yeah.
some other place, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I don't think that would be the case here.
So it passed the House. What was the vote in the House?
You know, I do not have that number in front of me. I wish I did.
Fair enough. But it
passed easily. I can tell you that.
And it easily passed the Senate. And then the governor seemed to be a little cheeky about her affiliation with this. She was saying up until the time she signed it in private that she would wait to see how it was written. Was there any doubt, though, that the governor would sign this?
I don't think there was, because Governor Ivey has been on the record for many years as a supporter of the sanctity of life. And, you know, the stage was set for this back in 2018 when Alabama voters passed a constitutional amendment affirming that we are a state committed to pro-life values and restricting any usage of state funds for abortion services. And, you know, a lot of people saw that as a fluff amendment, because as long as Roe v. Wade stands, it didn't really have any teeth. But it was sort of throwing down of the gauntlet, I felt like. And the governor was very much a proponent and in favor of that particular amendment. So even though she holds her cards pretty close to her chest about particular votes a lot of times, and she's careful about what she says, I don't think there was ever any doubt that she would sign the bill ultimately.
Lots of calls and texts about what they're doing in Alabama. My understanding is the bill won't become law, even though she signed it, until November, and that's if it survives whatever court tests awaited. Dana Hall McCain writes about faith, culture, and politics. She's a columnist at AL.com, a series of newspapers down there. I need to take a break. Let's come back and read some of your texts or hear some of your comments. The number's 312-981-7200 on WGN. We're visiting with Dana Hall McCain. You can read her piece at AL.com. That's where we first discovered her. She writes and is syndicated in a series of newspapers in Alabama. Her views on this, as she alluded to earlier, are decidedly with the legislators and the governor in Alabama. That is, this is, you know, finish that sentence, sound judgment or constitutionally reasonable, or I don't know, what's your personal take on that?
I do think it's constitutionally appropriate and morally and ethically appropriate.
This texter said, are they going to ban the morning after pill next? Literally, is there a conversation about that then?
You know, I have not heard conversation about that, but I would imagine that if you know, if there is an all-out ban on abortion, that it would include, you know, surgical abortion and oral medication-prompted abortion. So I would think that the morning after pill would fall into that category of being prohibited.
I don't know that a lot of movies or TV shows are being made in your state. It's not a knock against your state. I just don't know. But I know that Hollywood and some notable people have pushed back and said, well, then we're not going to go there. How does that resonate down there? Do people notice? Do they care? What are you all saying about that?
I don't think the average Alabama voter is worried about courting the approval of Hollywood or East Coast elites. That's just that's not their number one priority. When I tell you that it is a deeply religious state, and that many people do believe that they are answerable to God and to God alone. And I know that sounds like such hyperbole to people who don't come from a very religious culture. But yeah, it insulates them from a lot of the temptation to succumb to pressures like that. And I don't think that will have a big effect on Alabama voters or the popularity of these laws in our state.
Dana Hall-McCain. Listen, Dana, this is you've done us a great favor here, and I'd like to continue to talk to you down the road, particularly as we get closer to November or whatever court challenges await you all. So let's stay in touch and continue to follow this story together.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, John.
You can read her piece at AL.com, and you'll just love it or you just won't. That's at AL.com. Her name is Dana Hall-McCain. It's 229 W. Not so bad downtown Chicago right now. It was kind of spooky, kind of misty, kind of foggy. We had a little bit of rain here, and more of that may be coming. But at 303 East Wacker Drive on the south side of the Chicago River near the lake, it's not so bad right now. I wish you the same. Hopefully they'll get in that Northwestern game. Hopefully the White Sox play their game tonight. And hopefully everybody wins. Hopefully everyone wins, both Northwestern and Minnesota.
But if you had to pick, I mean,
well,
we're the home of the cats. I know.
I bet it online too.
I meant to talk to Dave about it, and I forgot.
I wouldn't do that. Is Mr. Jones here? Chris Jones is here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Waltz him right in. Listen, lots of calls, lots of texts about our last guest, who was talking about the new abortion law in Alabama. When we did the podcast with Patty Vasquez and Eric Zorn from the Tribune, Steve Bertrand and I, The Mincing Rascals will go up at 5 today. I recommend you listen to it. It's really good, even if it didn't win an award this year. Not that those are important. But anyway, the topic came up about this abortion law in Alabama. And Patty and Steve and Eric and I were talking a little bit about they have capital punishment in that state. Now, isn't that a conflict of terms or interests or ideas? You say that life is so sacred that you can't get an abortion in that state because it's life. Fair enough, understand that. And now you take somebody who's convicted of a heinous crime and you say, but we're going to kill you. And I asked our guest what the logic of that was in that state. And she said, here in Alabama, she said, you understand how we feel about conception, but we believe that child is innocent. In the case of, say, an adult who is incarcerated and has committed a crime so heinous that we have capital punishment, they're guilty. They're not innocent, and therefore we will take their life. So you can grapple with that all you want, but to at least the Mincing Rascals who are wondering what the logic of it is, that's what she said they think down there. It's 240 on WGN, and I'm not going to talk about that anymore. Chris Jones, are you out of breath? Do you need me to like take a break before I turn on your microphone?
I'm a professional.
You're a professional? You can do that because, listen, when I've rushed into a studio before, I didn't sound so good. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
So you said it was not news to you, but it was a little news to me. In the Tribune, at least online today, you wrote about how the production of Hamilton after 3 years and 3 months and maybe before more people in Chicago than in New York is going to end its run next January 5th.
Say it ain't so. It's people are really kind of going crazy about that news. It's really kind of a thing.
You're the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for running over here. But I like what at least the producer said. We would rather go out on a high without any vacancies on Wednesday afternoon. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, here's the thing. There's two schools of thought, right? Some people would say you've got a profitable show and you can leave it there. He could have left Hamilton here, I would assess, in my view, 2, 3, 4 years because profit margin's quite high. It makes more money than it takes to run. But on the other hand, then you've got, you know, a diminishment of the brand, as the economists say, you know, and you've got those empty seats. It's not quite as exciting for people. And you've got to remember, he's got other productions of it. For example, in New York City, where people are paying $500 a ticket, $800 a ticket. You don't really want it cut price in Chicago.
Where is it showing right now?
It's showing at the Richard Rogers Theater on Broadway. Then there are two different touring productions. Then there's a production in San Francisco and one in London.
Okay, so that's and then a permanent one in Chicago.
And then a permanent one here.
So Chicago,
January.
And New York, it's been there, and then four touring companies around the world.
That's right. And London is a permanent production. That's
so
right.
So three and three.
Yeah.
Because my brother saw it, or at least it came through Denver.
Yeah,
I don't know
if
it's still there.
Correct.
Right? So,
yeah.
So I guess that's not a dilution of the brand. But if it's now in Madison or Milwaukee, and now we've got empty seats in Chicago, he doesn't want to be there.
Well, I think so. Hamilton can go to any city for 2 weeks and command extraordinary amounts of money at the box office. If you're in Denver and you've never seen Hamilton, it's coming through for 2 weeks, you're paying a lot of money to go and see it. Here, you've got a permanent production. So here, it's not 2 weeks. It will have been 170 weeks. Now, this is a big city, lots of tourists, more people than really you would imagine have come to that show from far away. Something like half the audience lives more than 100 miles away. So if you're a waiter in the loop, or if you work at a front desk at a hotel, that's been very good for you. I mean, it's definitely driven people to the city. And when they're here, you know, they might go see a different show. They might have a steak at Morton's. They might do any kind of other thing. So the show has been a real positive for the city, I think.
You described as back-of-the-envelope math. You said if you just say what near capacity is for the run of the show at the going ticket price, that's $300 million. And if you do a conservative estimate of what that generates ancillarily, it's $1 billion it's done for the city.
Yeah, because, of course, what happens is that people buy a hotel room, and then, of course, they go out to eat, and they spend. So if you're spending, let's say, $200 on a ticket, the majority of those people coming from out of town are dropping another $500-$600. So in other words, you can take, you know, what the economists do is they say, okay, in let's say there's a multiple of 3 for every dollar spent on a ticket, that's $3 in the economy. So if you've got a total gross of Hamilton in the range of $350 million, and I will just say, I don't know, if you take out sports, I grant you sports, but if you take out sports, there has never been, I hereby declare, another live entertainment prospect in Chicago, a title, a show, a concert that has ever grossed $350 million. That's a lot of money. Even by your standards, John, it's a lot of money.
Why has it been so successful?
Well, that's, you know, if we all knew the answer to that, you and I could go out and make one of these and we could, you know, retire happy.
But just do a hip-hop historical thing.
I think my theories are, number one, that it had early support from President Obama, First Lady, so it became kind of a thing. It's about America, so it's people go because they want to take their kids, because it educates as well as entertains. It's really good, and, you know, let's not discount that. Most stuff is not really good. In all the people who I've sort of sent to Hamilton or who've called me up after they've been, no one has ever said it's not any good. So,
do you think the casting, as counterintuitive as it was when it first broke, played into its success?
No question, John. I mean, no question, because they made the diverse casting, the diversity of the casting is inherently part of the aesthetic of the show. And I don't know that any other Broadway musical, really any other live entertainment, has really done that as effectively as they did.
How many times have you seen it in Chicago?
I've only seen it twice in Chicago.
How many times have you seen it overall?
5.
I want to ask you, maybe you don't have a fresh answer for me, how good is it right now?
Well, the last time I saw it was in Puerto Rico. When they opened a new company in Puerto Rico, that was one of the... I've had a lot of interesting evenings in my life. I don't ever recall anything like that. I mean, Miranda, Lin-Manuel Miranda came out. The ovation was such that I didn't think they were going to be able to continue with the show. It was so great. And that was when I, you know, when I hang this up and I'm there, you know, on my deathbed, I'll be talking about that night. It was an incredible night. And that no other show could really have managed that. I, you know, there was this press conference in Puerto Rico after the show, and the local media were asking Lin-Manuel Miranda, like, what are you going to do about statehood? What are you going to do about Trump? What are you going to do about crime? And I'm standing there thinking, this is just a guy doing a musical, and look at this. That's what Hamilton somehow managed to do. And it's like no one had ever attempted it in any sort of artistic product before.
Or it would have been so heavy-handed. I don't know that he was trying to do that. If he says, okay, I'm going to do a musical, we'll talk about America and what it means, and therefore people will ask me, what do I think about Trump and crime? I think it would have seemed too preachy or didactic. This show isn't that. You can extrapolate from it, but I never sensed the one time I saw the show that he was telling me how to run my business today.
That's an excellent point. I think it just is a sort of organic show. There's somebody said to me, actually, I guess this was something that Stephen Sondheim said about the show. He described it as generous music. And what he meant by that is, so it's based in hip hop. But if your grandma goes to see it thinking, I'm not going to like this hip hop musical, then what happens is she gets there and she discovers it's not really all hip hop. There's all kinds of different music in it. So one of the great things we can all learn from the success of this endeavor is have broad appeal and be kind to everybody and tolerant and meet people where they are. I mean, these are all this is what young artists often fail to grasp, that people going to any entertainment is voluntary. People go because they want to be, you know, they want to see things in themselves. They don't go to listen to what you have to say to them, necessarily.
I want to ask the question I asked again a minute ago, though. So how is it today? And you described your moment in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
But I wonder if I went downtown Chicago next week, would I see something comparable to what Chicagoans saw in the first 3 months when it was in town?
Well, for one thing, you'd see the same guy playing Alexander Hamilton. So Miguel Cervantes has played that same role in every production. And I don't think, you know, I don't think there's been any diminishment in that show. It's you know, there have been certain stars in it that probably you might say, okay, they are better, we all have our favorite actors in those roles. There was a guy called Josh Henry who was in it early on, who was unbelievable. That I, you know, you go tonight,
as
you
don't, whom?
As Aaron Burr, and that, you know, that those stars are sort of gone now, and that is the way it is. But Miguel's still there, and it's a high quality show. The thing I think to really appreciate is that this world doesn't rely on individuals. It's not like a rock concert where it's all in the brand of a Mick Jagger or a Britney Spears. It's the show, so they have to keep it good, because otherwise, then people start, you know, then what they have begins to deteriorate.
Chris Jones is the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, announced today that January 5th of next year, there will be no more Hamilton in Chicago.
Sad news.
Do people come up and give you their review all the time?
All the time. You know what happened to me last night? I was at the Victory Gardens Theater and I was waiting. Valet parked. And there's a guy, the doorman, the valet parker guy, he goes, how many stars? I said, what's it to you? He said, do you want your car back?
Wow.
Only in Chicago, man.
Yeah. How many stars?
I added one, so I got my car back.
12.
However many you need.
I was disappointed in Hamilton.
You were not.
I was.
Why?
I don't know, because I'm better than everybody. That must be it, John. I think maybe because I'd been, you know, what happens to any show that's great, and then you go see it, and it doesn't live up to your expectation. I didn't think the second act was as good as the first, blah, 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 but I know I'm an outlier.
You are.
You don't hear that much at all.
I know, and the first time I've heard it.
That makes me feel kind of good,
that's
to be
good.
Honest with you.
Yeah.
So the show holds up. What's going to happen to tickets now?
That's the clever thing, right?
There's a deadline.
That's the clever thing. If you could see my Twitter feed today, so you know that news, Lin-Manuel is the master of Twitter, and he's sort of tweeted the story out. So it's just gone nuts. So now what'll happen is, I think, from now until January, it will be heavily sold. It's kind of brilliant. They're so good.
And will it be an upcharge? I'm going to be, or an uptick? I mean, market's going to go through the roof.
It is as they like to say, demand-based pricing. So I think you'll find that over the, here's when I think it'll be really expensive, is over the Christmas and New Year period.
So if you haven't seen it yet,
yeah,
and you think this show is good, fine, you better go get your tickets now.
Yeah, and I always say the best time to go, if you want a really a very good seat without paying much money, the quietest time for all these shows is usually September, just as the kids go back to school. So I would think about that if you want. And also, of course, on a weeknight, you know, those Tuesday, Wednesday nights, it's not, you know, it's not incredible. You could go tonight for not that much money. It's not, you know, the danger is that
100 and a half?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can get in there for under 100 if you don't mind crap seat. But, I mean, if you want a very good seat, most weeknights, 100 and a half. I think on a weekend, you're probably 225. But that's about half what it is in New York.
A funny thing happened to my brother with his ticket. Can I tell you a little story? Chris Jones, theater critic, Chicago Tribune, in our studio writing today and visiting with us about Hamilton. So the last show is going to be January 5th. They announced. You explained the logic of that to us. So you endorse or support their decision to move out of Chicago after the first of the year?
I wouldn't say I endorse it. I understand it. It makes sense from their point of view. It's probably not great from Chicago's point of view, where it's better for us just to have the show. But from their point of view, they'd rather go out on a high. They'd rather go out with every ticket sold. And, you know, you have to look hard to find any ads for Hamilton. There's not many of them. There's the odd taxi. That's it. So they don't like to spend money to get ticket sales.
They don't have to, hardly.
No, they don't have to. So they'd rather just go. They just have a unique product that it's, you know, it's a funny business, show business, because it's scarcity. You have to to some degree, you want to create the perception that it's really hard to get a ticket, even if it isn't.
Yeah, or is. And when the show went to Denver, where my brother and sister-in-law live, the tickets were in such demand. The secondary market was so great that he sold the ticket that he had and then bought plane tickets, flew to Chicago, and got better seats.
There you go.
He made so much money on the secondary market from a ticket that he was able to sell it, fly to Chicago, stay here, and watch it in good seats, and still have money in his pocket for dinner.
And commune with his brother while he was here.
Everybody won.
Everybody wins.
Well, it's nice to see you, Chris. So anything else I can do for you? What are you writing about besides this? Anything you want to plug? You got a show? You sing? You dance?
I've got a big new book out, which is actually partly about Hamilton. It's called Rise Up, is the name of it, and it's sort of the story of how Broadway created Hamilton. It's sort of about, you know, just how we got to that point. What were the forces that actually brought that together? It talks a bit about, you know, the end of the Obama administration and then the beginning of Hamilton. And there's the thing in it too I talk about, which is sort of interesting to me, about if you look at all the controversial Trump tweets, like there's many of them, as we all know. The very first one that really got attention on Twitter was actually about Hamilton, when Mike Pence went to, if you remember that, Pence goes to Hamilton, and they get booed, and Trump the next morning is like, unfair, and I was like, wow, when they write the history of Trump's tweets, as you know they will, somebody will write a narrative about that, Hamilton will figure.
We're out of time. The book is called Rise Up.
Rise Up, yeah.
I don't have this book. How long has it been out?
I got it just a few weeks. I'll have to get you a copy.
Oh, you'll have to come back. I'll read the book and I'll tell you what I think about it.
All right, John.
I know you can't wait for my review. Read Chris Jones in the Chicago Tribune and read that book called Rise Up when you get it.